The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. If you've been listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show for any period of time, you know I have a very high bar when it comes to thrillers. And crossing that bar easily is M.P. Woodward, who joined me for the first time. His brand new book, Dead Drop, Cannot Be Dropped. You start it and you can't put it down. M.P. Woodward, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. What the heck do I call you? I don't want to call you M.P. Woodward over and over again.
Yeah, you can call me Mike. That's okay, Hugh. I know you'll say the name of the book seven times.
Oh, you've got that down. Dead Drop, Dead Drop, Dead Drop. But more importantly, you know, I started out with Vince Flynn 20 years ago, and Brad Thor and CJ Box, and of course, Danny Silva. They're all friends of mine. I'm very hard to impress on a thriller, and I'm very impressed. How do you go from being a Navy intel officer to Amazon to deciding to write thrillers, and not only thrillers, really good thrillers?
Yeah, well, one thing, Hugh, is that when I was in the Navy, I was with U.S. Indo-PACOM and actually wrote war game exercises. And when you do those, you know, you're trying to stimulate commands all over that hemisphere, and you're coming up with message traffic and scenarios for every kind of thing imaginable. So that was pretty good training for somebody who wanted to write thrillers.
You know, I saw that come through when you're writing about Camp Perry, which is the farm. I have two kids in the Navy. One is an aviator, one is an intel officer, and they've both gone through SEER in different places, one in Maine and one in Western Washington State. Where did you do your survival, evasion, recovery, et cetera? Where did you do yours?
Some in Pensacola and some at what you talked about in Eastern Washington.
That's it, Eastern Washington, not Western Washington, Eastern Washington. That was not a very pleasant experience.
Yeah.
That was not fun.
No, it's never... No, but you lose some weight. That's the good part about it.
Oh, boy, the aviator came back, I mean, really skinny. Let's talk about Dead Drop. I didn't know a lot about Iranian CIA. What is MOIS? And do we refer to it as MOIS or do we call it the MOIS?
We call it MOIS, but it's the Ministry of Intelligence and Security within Iran, yeah.
And so I actually have not read much about how the IRGC and Quds interacts with MOIS. Where did you figure this out? That's, by the way, what gets me into a thriller. Believability, granularity in the detail. How did you learn about MOIS?
A couple ways. Well, first off, at a macro level, I'm super concerned about the Iranian nuclear program. Every day we're looking at the news. I mean, they are very, very close to what people call breakout, which is enriched U-235 to 90%. They're building a deep underground facility. So when I started to look into this as to how to dramatize that and how to bring that to life in a thriller, I thought a lot about, well, everybody knows about the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, sort of this parallel force to the Iranian military with good capabilities. But in terms of their counterintelligence capabilities, we don't talk a lot about that, a lot about the tactics that they have. And they do some scary things. They attempted to kidnap an American a few years ago. They kidnapped people regularly. And I got started on this by reading a number of biographies, really, and memoirs of people who had actually been in that side of the Iranian national security establishment, who defected, those types of things. And I actually talked to a few as well.
Well, this has got great tradecraft in it, but it's also got sort of a schematic on how this operation works. And I'm going to go right to Hezbollah. We're going to come back after the break and talk about the Mossad-CIA relationship, because I think you've done that very well. But within the IRGC, within MOIS, is it getting bigger or is it just aging out? Because the colonel who's in charge is kind of a screw-up, and he's old and he's got the bad beard. Are they replenishing the well from that original revolutionary moment, or is it aging out?
I think it's aging out. And I tried to portray that, you know, it was a 1979 revolution. And then that was followed really by officers within that corps that made their bones in the war with Iraq. And so I think as I looked into this, there are a number of veterans from that force who are getting pretty old. And I wanted to portray that a little bit with a younger set of people coming up, a little more technologically astute, fairly clever, and also ambitious.
Now, let me also give people a little clue. And I don't do spoilers. That's why I only read half a book before. Danny Silva is always frustrated because I always guess the end, and I try to guess the end. Sometimes I'm right. But I never do spoilers. But I will give this spoiler on page 89. There's a program that the book centers around. And I don't know how to pronounce dragon in Farsi. How do you pronounce that word? Tainim?
Tainin.
Tainin.
Tainin, yeah.
And you write that HBO is showing Game of Thrones throughout the Middle East, so Tainin is showing up in all the intercepts because it's dragon. That's just a brilliant little detail. I thought, actually, our agencies might start doing that just to get... Did you make that up? Did that just occur to you, or did you read that somewhere?
No, I invented it, let's put it that way. But what I wanted to highlight... In all my books, what I try to highlight is that there are 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, and the job of any given intelligence officer is to collate that information coming from all these different types of sources. And sifting through, so this would be something that NSA is doing, and sifting through all that information to find something useful for some intelligence officer working on solving a puzzle was what I was trying to illustrate.
And it comes to Dead Drop is great. I'm going to keep talking with Mike after the break. Welcome back, America. If you listened to my podcast yesterday, you heard this interview, but I'm playing it again because I want people to hear the entire conversation with MP Woodward, Mike Woodward, about his brand new thriller, Dead Drop, which I now have a new author. I'm so happy when new people enter the list, because otherwise I just have to wait for CJ Box, Danny Silva, and Brad Thor to write a book. Now you have. Mike, do I have to go back? Can I read Handler? I haven't read Handler yet. So this is my first MP Woodward. Does Handler, is it a prequel, or is it a series, or is it a complete standalone?
The Handler was the first book. Dead Drop follows with the same universe of characters, so it's the Handler series.
Okay, I've got to go back and read the Handler then. That will tell me a little bit about John and Meredith then, I assume. Is that part of the exfil?
Certainly. You get their origin story, and they in that book they exfil an embedded agent who's within the Iranian Quds Force, and then in Dead Drop that they have that agent, and the action kicks off because they need him to tell them something. Of course, whatever he knows, he's being cagey and holding that back, and then Israel's Mossad doesn't like the fact they suspect that the Americans have this asset and are holding him back for political reasons. And, you know, they're not going to sit by as an existential threat grows just to be nice.
Did you invent the term red page? It's new to me. And so I thought, boy, that would be a good term if he made it up, but maybe he just got it from someone.
No, it's a real thing. So within the Israeli national security infrastructure, you know, they actually do carry out targeted assassinations and killings, and I refer to a number of those in the book that are based on real things, and that there's a process in Israel where the prime minister approves and it's called a red page, and approves it and hands it off to the director of Mossad. Now, based on my research, the Mossad director can't do an assassination until they get this red page. But yeah, it's a real thing.
Now, Red Page, their Red Pages book is going to be like my old Yellow Pages book, because they've gotten a lot of Iranian scientists over the last 20 years. You also borrow the technical details, I think, from the remote control takeout of a nuclear scientist. Was that built on that episode?
Yeah, it was. And so there was this really, I thought it was so chilling and operationally interesting that I wanted to highlight it as something that Mossad was effectively celebrating in the book at having carried this off. And so in that incident, and I think it's emblematic of several incidents that they've done, but you have Kurdish sympathizers within Iran. They smuggle in parts that to build a machine gun that has servos that becomes automated via, you know, a satellite data link. And they park this pickup truck on a street corner where they know an Iranian scientist is coming. And he was on, I think he was on vacation, and he was coming back to the office, and this thing got activated. And it was a very precise, really, you know, chilling episode. And that is something that I wanted to show, that this is what they do. That particular scientist had almost bragged that, yep, I'm the main guy in Iran that knows everything. Yep, I know I'm wanted. And he was sort of arrogant about it and met his end.
Yeah, put a target on your own back and you can be sure the Mossad's going to zero in on it. MP Woodward, let's talk in Dead Drop as well. There's an interesting part of this about the Mossad-CIA relationship. Pompeo's a buddy of mine. I haven't asked him this, but now I'm going to. Do you think Mossad would ever really try and recruit a former CIA asset agent?
I think Mossad has recruited several intelligence personnel. So there was a, you know, there was a famous, was Jonathan Pollard, was
yes.
a U.S. Navy intelligence analyst. They recruited him back in the 70s. There were complaints as early as 2018 that Mossad was recruiting people. Now, I take it a little farther and make that a former CIA officer. But the thing I'm really trying to highlight there, Hugh, is that in all these intelligence agencies, they're not big, you know, monolithic things. They're staffed with regular people, and these people have relationships. And I think those bidirectional relationships between CIA and Mossad are more often than not very productive and good things. But I wanted to play around with that and see if they could be exploited as well.
I do not know if you know that on the Times of Israel on Thursday morning, the morning we tape this, is the headline, Iran unveils new missile with 2,000 kilometer range capable of hitting Israel. I don't know if you've read the news this morning. So
I did read that, yes.
So it's very timely that Dead Drop comes along and talks about cruise missiles that can drop packages into the middle of Israel and the silent war. You have one of your character who, by the way, is Junction actually part of Mossad? Is that a team or did you make that up?
No, that's a team. And one of the things I wanted to bring to the book was there's lots of books out there that, you know, talk about Mossad as though it's magic and can do anything. But I wanted to break this down into its operational wing, which is called Caesarea, and then also mention Junction, which is the group that recruits foreigners throughout. And also to show that one of Mossad's great strengths is that Israel is a nation of immigrants, a young country, 75 years old, and it brings people in that speak foreign languages, that look like foreigners, et cetera. And Mossad takes advantage of that. They're the second largest intelligence agency in the world after the CIA, and they are extremely capable. So I wanted to show a little bit about how they work.
I thought Junction, that's a reveal to me. And I read a lot of this stuff for my real job, which is trying to stay abreast of national security. You have one of, I think it's Mitt says, quote, we've got people in Hezbollah, of course. And I thought to myself, I wonder if they do. What do you think, Mike?
Oh, without a doubt, I think they do. And they've gone to war several times in Lebanon over the years. And it's now politically toxic and something that's argued about, which I try to present in the book. Yep. And I think, you know, the way that they're going to handle something that's politically toxic is to make sure it never grows to be a hot active war. At least they're going to try that. So what I wanted to portray was that when we talk about Iran getting nuclear weapons capability or enriching U-235 to 90%, which the intelligence community calls breakout, it's not just about Iran and their theater ballistic missiles, like you mentioned. It's also the fact that they have a supply line that goes, you know, from Iran through Syria into Lebanon to Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is a state within a state. And we have a good official State Department relationship with the country of Lebanon. However, everyone is hands off with Hezbollah, which is a country within a country sitting on Israel's northern border. So the idea that Iran develops a nuclear warhead and somehow gets it to Hezbollah is something that we should all be thinking about.
So MP Woodward, I want to wrap up talking about Dead Drop by asking you very specifically, did you go into this to sell books or did you go into this to educate people about threats? Because thriller writers come to this for different reasons.
Yeah, I think every thriller topic that I come up with, and I'm just finishing up my fourth book. There's a lag, as you know, Hugh, in publishing, but every topic that I explore is meant to help educate and expose some facts that I come across in my research. In this case, for example, as I was looking into Israel and Hezbollah and the history there, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, puts out, they do a kind of a great job of trying to publicize threats to get the world to pay attention. So you can actually go on IDF websites and they will talk extensively and very openly about missile production facilities right in southern Beirut in an area called the Dahiyeh, which is the where the Shia Muslims are that are Hezbollah, run by Hezbollah. And there are missile production facilities there, and there's not a lot they can do about them. And the IDF does this because they want the world to act and react. And when you couple that with the fact that, you know, the consensus opinion out there is that Iran is very close to breakout, this is something that's very troubling.
Now it is. Now let me, my last question, Mike. Will you tackle the Chinese Communist Party? I ask all my thriller buddies, please take on the CCP. Brad Thor has done it a little bit because it's the only way Americans, we need a Le Carre for China, but it's awfully difficult for Americans to figure it out. What do you think about that challenge?
Oh, man. I mean, that's my last two books, which will come out soon. Both deal with China. My particular area of expertise and my background and the thing that I'm concerned about is the Chinese Navy. I was the president of a Taiwanese company during my tech career, you know, spent a lot of time in Taiwan. As a naval officer, I was in the Taiwan Straits. You know, around 2015, 2016, we were at parity with the Chinese Navy, around 290 ships. We had 294 ships then. By 2025, we'll have 290. So we shrink. They go to more than 400 combat-capable platforms, which is something that is really, really scary because they're building a power projection navy, a blue water navy, to guard the sea lines of communication. That's something that they're going to strip away from the United States. And when you look at our dependence on technology and manufacturing that comes out of Asia, that is a very, very scary prospect. So the thing that I've been writing about is really around more around that battle problem and the naval battle problem and how a war like that might be fought in the very near term, as opposed to, say, you know, 2035, right?
We're in the Davidson kind of window. We're in there. And so I've got to go back and read Handler. People have got to read Dead Drop, which is available now. When does the next MP Woodward book come out when you start to turn to China?
It will come out probably in May of 2024. And if we lean on our publisher, Penguin Random House, Berkeley's the imprint, you know, maybe that can be sooner.
Great start. I mean, Dead Drop is a hook. It's an addictive book. And Mike, congratulations on that. Dead Drop will be a bestseller. Keep coming back. And thank you for writing about the CCP. I already knew enough about Iran, but I love learning more. I need to know a lot more about the CCP. Well done. And keep coming back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you, Mike.
It's been great to be in the universe. Thanks, Hugh.
Thank you. Senator J.D. Vance of the great state of Ohio joins me. Good morning, J.D. How are you?
Good, Hugh. How are you doing?
I am great. Now, Senator, I was a little surprised to see you endorse Bernie Moreno, who's running to be your seatmate in the Ohio Senate against Sherrod Brown. There are other people in the primary. That's very early in a primary. I stay out of these things, but why did J.D. Vance get involved this early?
Well, a few things. First of all, Bernie's a really good friend. We knew each other before politics. I know that he's sort of a guy who keeps his word. That's important to me, and that's not a criticism of any other candidates. It's just a very strong endorsement of Bernie Moreno and the kind of person that he is. But also, if we sort of dig into the weeds and some of the broader issues that are going on in the Republican Party, you know, I'm a little bit more skeptical of our trade posture vis-a-vis China. I think that's become more of a majority issue. But I know Bernie Moreno was right there 5-10 years ago. So I think on a lot of the big issues where I see this sort of intra-party debate going on, I think Bernie's going to be a good ally for me. And I think importantly, he can beat Sherrod Brown. That's the final point, right? Sherrod is a very, very good candidate. There's a reason he's been able to thrive so well in Republican politics, or I should say politics generally, in the state of Ohio for the past, you know, 4 or 5 decades. And I think we're going to need a guy who brings something fresh, who can make a new kind of argument. I think that's Bernie Moreno.
Let's talk a little bit about Sherrod Brown, because like Howard Metzenbaum before him, we always seem to send one Democrat and one Republican from Ohio, and you are now the Republican. But Sherrod Brown is pretty out of step with Ohio today, isn't he, J.D. Vance?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, Sherrod has always had this kind of populist thing going on that's made him a very effective politician within the state of Ohio. But if you look at his voting record on things like crime, on a lot of social issues, he's really gotten out of step with where the electorate is. And so I expect Sherrod to lean pretty aggressively into some of the economic issues where he's a little bit closer to the middle Ohioan and completely avoid some of the culture war stuff where frankly, he's been a very partisan Democrat. And again, this is sort of why a guy like Bernie Moreno makes a lot of sense, because he can get in there and make that really effective contrast that we're going to need so that the people of Ohio know exactly who we're dealing with and why we need to send a Republican to represent them.
Are you going to be endorsing, like I've got Governor Jim Justice coming up next hour, also may have a primary contest. Are you going to make a habit of endorsing in primary, Senator Vance?
No, I'm not. I mean, look, I endorsed President Trump very early. My attitude is, when you think you've got the right guy, you should just go in for him. I didn't think too much about what the timing of either of these endorsements. I just thought, look, I'm going to support these guys. I supported Trump early. I supported Moreno early. I haven't been asked by Jim Justice to endorse him. You know, if people ask me in that race, I'll think about it. But by and large, my attitude is you should stay out of these things unless you have a particular stake in it, or unless you have a strong view. And if you have a strong view, you might as well tell people that. Now, I'll say simultaneously, nothing against Matt Dolan, who's declared, or some of the other candidates who are non-declared. We're going to have a tough primary in the state of Ohio, but importantly, it needs to not be a dirty primary, Hugh. Another way that you reelect a Democrat in the state of Ohio is that you destroy your fellow Republicans in the primary. I expect Bernie won't do that. I hope the other guys follow suit.
All right, let me turn to national politics, the default discussion. I don't think we're going to default. I think they'll come up with a deal. I think that they'll have the House in session next week and the Senate will come back and pass it. I refuse to get excited about it. What does Senator Vance think about it?
Yeah, that's basically my attitude to you. I mean, look, the markets are still clearly skeptical that we're going to have a default on the United States debt. That would be a cataclysmic event for the world economy, for the American economy. The thing that really bothers me about this whole debate, Hugh, is that we're conflating default, meaning the United States not paying the principal and interest on its debt, with questions about the extraordinary measures that Janet Yellen can use as we get down to the wire on this debt ceiling debate. And look, we have no idea when the U.S. Treasury actually runs out of money, in part because Janet Yellen refuses to tell us. And I suspect that the folks at Treasury are being opaque about this. They're being unclear because they want to put pressure on Republicans. But you know, just a very sort of wonky point here, Hugh. About mid-June is when tax receipts from quarterly tax payments more than make up for federal outlays. What that means in practice is the federal government's going to have plenty of money to run itself by end of June, early July. There is a universe here where we get all spun up about the debt ceiling, and then we don't actually have to have the real debate until mid-July. We just need to be honest about the options here, because I think these guys are using the lack of clarity, to really apply a lot of pressure to Republicans.
You know, Senator, I just don't believe Secretary Yellen. I just don't. And the extraordinary measures are actually sort of what Americans do every month who have got a little shortfall here or there, is they pay some bills first and they pay some bills later. And if they have a 30-day pay, they make sure they pay it on day 29. Even the most responsible person doesn't pay early. I just don't believe anyone in the Biden administration about anything. Do you?
No, I don't. And this gets to my point about leverage on Republicans. If this was really about the country being unable to pay its debts, and not just about creating artificial deadlines to force congressional Republicans onto the Biden administration timeline, I think we'd see them responding much differently to the last couple of days' negotiations. But they haven't, and I think it's clear the reason they haven't is they don't see this as nearly the crisis they're trying to project onto the American public. Republicans should stand firm. We should negotiate. We should, of course, pay the country's debts, and I think we're going to do that. And, of course, Hugh, to make the point fine, we've already offered a plan that does precisely that.
That is what we've done. Now, talk to me a little bit about the appropriations coming after. Senator Vance, which committees did you end up on?
I am on Commerce and Banking, so no appropriations for me.
Well, then, good. Let's talk about banking, because I brought this up with Patrick McHenry when he was on. I actually don't know if my deposits are at any risk anywhere, because it seems to me that the federal government now picks which deposits are going to be made good above $250,000 and those which aren't. And it's a nightmare for bankers. Have you figured out yet that this is that they're picking winners and losers?
Oh, yeah. No, this was the fundamental takeaway from the SVB thing, is that if you're well-connected and you're an uninsured depositor, then the federal government will make you whole. But, of course, if you're a community bank with $3 billion of depositors or $8 billion of depositors, then the federal government's probably not going to make you whole. And that uncertainty, Hugh, is one of the reasons why you've seen a massive migration to the massive banks. The thing I worry most about is that too big to fail has effectively become a massive subsidy. The American people are aware of this now, and so you have the migration of capital into banks like JPM and Citi. Well, is that actually good for the American economy to have effectively three or four banks? Because that's the trajectory that we're headed on. I think the answer is absolutely not. We have to preserve our regional and community banking ecosystem. We're going to work on a number of things, already have, but we'll work on more over the next couple of years to solve this problem. But a crazy statistic is that JP Morgan, the largest bank, I believe has added a PNC, the seventh largest bank, in depositors just in the last couple of years. That's because of the policies coming out of Washington. We've got to stop this.
Yeah, well, I go to a friend of mine who makes shopping carts, and they have a monthly payroll of $3 million. Now, they're a good-sized business, but they're not giant. They make shopping carts, and they can't, you know, they don't want to move their money from their community bank because they have a great relationship with the community bankers. At the other point, they're saying, wait a minute, if my money's not insured here, but it is insured with the big four, I've got to move to a big four. That, it's just like we're making the small banks collapse.
Well, that's exactly what we're doing. And if you think of the incredible subsidy that exists there, if you're a JP Morgan and you have this implied guarantee of all your depositors, but if you're a small community bank and you don't, I mean, these guys will not stay in business indefinitely under that regime, which is why we have to change it.
And moreover, if you concentrate deposits at the big four, you get their ESG DEI policies. And I don't know what they are at the big four, but I suspect they are very Manhattan-ish, very blue bubble-ish. Do you agree, or do you think I'm being too hard on them?
No, I don't think you're being too hard on them at all. Look, some of them are worse and some of them are better, but absolutely they've gone pretty far into the progressive stuff. They've tried to project progressive values onto the broader economy, and they've used their financial power to force the American people to swallow a number of, let's be honest, very liberal policies and politics that I don't think the American people care to have as part of their banking relationship or their banking system. So this is a problem. It's the political problem. It's the economic problem. If you look, Hugh, at new business formation in our country compared to, let's say, certain parts of Europe where they have a more concentrated banking system, it is not a coincidence that the most innovative economy also has the most diversified financial sector. That is going to change unless we fix what's going on in Washington.
Senator J.D. Vance, always a pleasure from the great state of Ohio. Go Guardians, go Reds, and go Browns. Thank you, Senator. We're not going to say go Bengals on this show. Good to have you. Keep coming back, and we'll talk to you again soon. Don't go anywhere, America. I got lots more coming up. As I said, Governor Justice is going to be joining the United States Senate with J.D. Vance in the next come 2025. We talk with Governor Justice next hour. I also want to thank you all for support. With 3 days, we've been doing this full on 3 days. We've raised $40,000 from just this show. That's sending 200 plus kids to camp. And we're going to double and triple that, I hope. You can give another $40,000 if you'd like. You can give $4 or $40,000. You can give $10 or $10,000 at hughhewitt.com. The banner is at the top, the Angel Tree Camp. Listen to Don T, who is a camper who's going back to Angel Tree as a counselor this summer.
We wake up, we have breakfast, and then we usually play some games. And then if you're older, we might have like a Bible study before worship. We worship till lunch, and it's a blast, you know? Everybody's jumping, we're singing. After lunch, we didn't have like free time. We do crafts, we go swimming, we do all that stuff, all that fun stuff. I mean, I love camp. That's why I want to keep coming back.
They do want to keep coming back, and they want to expand the group of children that they can gather in. So when you go from being a camper to a counselor, that is all the validation you need, that this is money well spent, and it's gospel money as well. You're really being an evangelist, but mostly you're caring for kids whose mom and or dad are in prison. Go to Angel Tree at the top of HughHewitt.com. Please be generous. Come right back. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, broadcasting from Studio North this morning, and pleased to welcome for the first time to the Hugh Hewitt Show, Governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice. Governor Justice, welcome. Great to have you on the show.
Hugh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
I was a little bit worried because a lot of you West Virginians are Steelers fans. I'm from Warren, Ohio, and I'm a Browns fan. I don't let any Steelers fans on, but then I read your bio. You're a Saints fan. How did that happen?
Well, I got to be really close friends with Sean Payton. I think the world of him and everything. Wish him great, great, great success with the Denver Broncos. But a good man, and you know, we enjoyed our time, you know, together. And I hope we have a whole lot more together. But I got to tell you this and everything. But you know, of course, you know, our family owns the Green Bar Hotel and everything. But the Browns are coming, you know, to the Green Bar Hotel for I think 10 days here, not too long, and so. So, and I grew up, believe it or not, I grew up a Browns fan all, you know, through and through. So
bonus. That's a bonus. You know, I didn't know that Kevin Stefanski's taking him down there. They got to get train early because they're playing in the Hall of Fame game this year against the Jets. But they're going to the Greenbrier, my father's favorite hotel in the world. He's gone to be with the Lord. But I'm telling you, the Greenbrier, I didn't know you owned the Greenbrier either. You're kind of an amazing guy. Why do you want to go to the Senate? It's going to drive you crazy.
Well, there's no doubt it'll probably drive me crazy to some degree, and there's no you know thing that I just adore about Washington D.C. But with all that being said, you know, Hugh, my dad would always say over and over, you know, if you know, son, and the good Lord knows, that's all that really matters. And really, at the end of the day, Hugh, the reason is one thing and one thing only. I'm a patriot. I am genuinely, really, really worried about this country and the path that we're going on. I mean, we are about to completely implode, and there's no guarantee that we're invincible. And if we don't take the Senate back in 2024, we don't have hardly any chance in 26, 28. And I don't know that the country will survive beyond that. And so
I'm pretty sure you get along with Joe Manchin, but Joe Manchin's been part of the problem. Do you get along with him, and what are you talking to him about? Because you're going to beat him like a drum. I mean, you're going to win by 10 to 15%.
Well, I do get along with Joe, and Joe's got a lot of charisma, and he's got a lot of political power in West Virginia, and that's what's enabled Joe to survive. But I would tell Joe this if he was sitting right here. You know, the difference in me and Joe and a lot of people is I don't want anything. You know, Joe always seems to want something. And so with all that being said, and he has a track record of always migrating back to the Democratic Party, you know, at the last minute, you know, I'm not going to play games with people. I don't do that, Hugh. I just tell people the truth. I don't blow smoke at anybody. And you know, I will beat Joe Manchin if he decides to run. But I think what Joe Manchin will do is try to run for president on the independent side. And I don't think that will really go very far. But I think, you know, if I'm in the race, I think there's a likelihood that Joe will not run. But at the same time, if whatever happens, I get run over by a car tomorrow and everything, and you know, my opponent is the nominee, Joe Manchin will run for sure. And against Alex Mooney, he would beat Alex Mooney to death. So if we got a real shot, and that's why I'm doing this.
I don't often get involved before a primary, but I am involved here. I want Republicans in West Virginia, and they listen to vote for Governor Justice because he's a winner and we'll get it done. Governor, I did not know that you were a farmer. I knew you had mines. I didn't know you were a farmer, and I didn't know you owned the Greenbrier. What in the world does an executive who's been governor for 8 years think the Senate's going to be like? Because I know you know Mitch McConnell, and I know you got friends down there, and you talk with Joe. But it's going to be a nightmare for people who like to get things done.
Well, it could very well be. And I promise you that, long time ago, if I could tell you this real quick, I ran for the Board of Education of all things, and this was decades ago. And I was elected overwhelmingly and everything. And a lot of people said, Jim, business law and business rules, but you don't know school law and you won't be able to get anything done here and all that. And the same thing with the government, Jim, your businesses and what you can do there and you can't do. And you can't do those things in government, being the governor or whatever. Well, I really always believed that my dad would have, I've got to tell you, I stood in front of my dad's desk one time and said, and I was probably skinny and had brown hair. And I said, Dad, what do you think I could do? And he just leaped forward and grabbed me around my, shirt and slammed me down on the desk. He said, damn you. There's always something you can do, and you better damn well always remember that. Well, that's how I live. And really and truly, just because it's tough, just because it's difficult, we've got to figure a way because we're worth it. This country is worth it. And so we got to find a way.
Now, Governor, I think a lot of people are complacent right now about the Chinese Communist Party. And I know that's far removed from state houses, but I talked to Doug Ducey about it. I talked with Mike DeWine about it. I talked with Ron DeSantis about it, Chris Sununu. The governors are kind of onto the fact that the Chinese communists are everywhere and they're eating our lunch. Is that part of the motivation?
Well, sure. Listen, Hugh, the one thing that I won't do, everybody wants to get up on a soapbox and say, look at me. Well, I'm not about to do that. But I can tell you this, that the display of weakness that we continue to do all across the globe and everything absolutely comes home to roost with us. China is absolutely becoming stronger and stronger every day. And for God's sakes, a living, they're dictating to us. And absolutely, what do? Cow down. We should trade together. We should be friends some way, somehow. But for God's sakes, a living, we're the United States of America. We have to be the strongest. We have to absolutely be able to help people throughout the world, but not absolutely babysit everybody throughout the world. But really, when it really boils right down to it, it's a crying shame when you step back and think of the responsibilities of the bad things that have happened, many of them that absolutely lie right with China, and we don't do a thing.
So, Governor, let me ask you about the Republican side on the presidential. Last night, Governor DeSantis, one of your colleagues, rolled out his campaign. I think Governor Sununu is going to join. I don't know if you're going to endorse anyone. I'm sure you worked with my buddy Doug Ducey for many years. Does being governor help prepare someone to be president?
It does. Without any question, the strength of being able to make decisions, the strength of absolutely running your own shop or running a store and minding the store in the correct way, there's no question that it does. But, from the standpoint of being able to run a business, I don't see how career politicians that have really never had a job, ask ourselves the question, how do they become wealthy? It's the most bizarre thing in the world on the salaries that they're supposed to be paid. Yet, absolutely, being able to have run stuff, from the standpoint of President Trump and all of his businesses, governors and running stuff, their own shop and everything. We should absolutely take notice of that because it's very important.
What is the website, Governor Justice, if people want to contribute to your Senate campaign? By the way, this is the linchpin campaign. This will flip the Senate back to 50-50. Then we got to win in Pennsylvania and Ohio and a couple other places, Montana. But this is ground zero for flipping the Senate. How do people help you?
It's JimJusticeWV.com.
And JimJusticeWV.
JimJusticeWV.com.
So I have one more question, Governor. I'm 67, and I've been watching West Virginia from across the river for a long time. And it used to be you couldn't turn around, you didn't hit four Democrats. Now, if you go down there, go to Charleston, you can't turn around without hitting four Republicans in every direction. What happened in West Virginia to go from a deep blue state to a deep red state?
Barack Obama. That's exactly what happened. You know, there is no question whatsoever. Now, I would tell you just this, you know, Manchin still has real power in West Virginia as a Democrat. And I can tell you that going back to exactly what we have got to do as Republicans now, we got to take control of the Senate. I mean, if we don't take control of the Senate now, shame on us forevermore. Because if there's any state that we've got to have, it's West Virginia. And absolutely, if we can slam dunk West Virginia as Republicans, what we should do then is take the excess dollars and pour them into Montana and Ohio. You know, but absolutely, West Virginians, to me, you know, and I'm so proud of them, it's unbelievable. And I say this very selfishly, but they seem to always be able to get it right. They got it right even in the midterms. You see, West Virginians overwhelmingly in the midterms voted Republican. The reason they did that, they didn't do that for the state candidates. They did that because they were voting against the administration in D.C. They were voting against the Biden administration. And I truly believe that we should have swept all across the board in 2022. What on God's earth happened to us? You know, and so we can't screw this one up now.
No, I mean, bad candidates. Bad candidates mean you lose elections. You're a good candidate because you've won before. Governor, keep coming back. JimJusticeWV.com. Did I get that right? JimJusticeWV.com?
Got it right, Hugh. And thank you for all you do every day. Thank you so
much. All right,
much.
Go Browns. We got to bring you back to the Browns faithful. Go see Jimmy Haslam and get that Browns T-shirt on. I'll give you my logo cup in the back. Thank you, Governor.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.